mean, obviously, it's for children. It's pretty clear. It's Captain Underpants. You know, you're not going to go for somebody in their mid-30s. You're going to go for somebody who's, you know, maybe 10.
Excuse me, I am in my early 30s.
That's not what I meant, and you know it.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. I am Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California, and with me today is special guest, friend of the show, Amanda Kowalski from Orange County, California.
How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. It's a late night special. I'm recording after work. Which is usually how we do it, but I don't know. I feel like I'm slightly imposing on another person's life schedule.
A little. I have to wake up in like 6 hours.
I am sorry about tomorrow. I'll just say that in advance.
I'm just going to buy myself a lot of coffee.
Whatever happens tomorrow is my fault.
I will blame you.
Entirely.
I will blame you when I go to work.
I guess today we're going to be talking about It Comes at Night, which is a movie I saw when I was taking my little staycation in Las Vegas. And we might talk about Captain Underpants. And at the end of the program, we're not going to have a Netflix homework because the dog ate my homework. But we will be recommending some stuff that's on different streaming sites.
Yay.
Yay.
I know all of the streaming sites, so I'm perfect for this.
Yes, you are. Most people other than me are. But I did want to talk to you a little bit at the top of the show. You've been doing this like 365 movie challenge.
I have, yeah.
This year. And how well have you stuck to it? Because I know you were going pretty strong early on in the year. But
this is the 170th day, and I have watched 170 movies. So
congratulations.
I mean, I guess thank you.
Yeah. Now, can you describe to the listeners, like, what is the, like, what is the goal? Like, I mean, what are the parameters? I guess everybody gets to set their own kind of rule book on this, but what's your personal rule book?
Actually, it's kind of interesting because everybody has different opinions on like what makes a movie and stuff like that. Especially now that streaming services are so big, right? So like there's movies on Netflix that are just short films, right? And if I watch a 15-minute movie, am I actually watching a movie for the day or am I not, right?
I would say no.
Yeah, I would say no too. But at the same time, you know, if I watch a Comedy Central special or something like that, but it's on Netflix, it's still counted as a movie in Netflix's archives and stuff like that. So it's technically a movie. It's over an hour long. So, yeah, it's a movie, but would you count it as a movie? I know. It's kind of iffy, right?
Well, it depends. Like, if it's like just a stand-up special, like the new Dave Chappelle shows or something, that's stretching it. But if it's like a documentary, like one of those, like, Kings of Comedy or the Comedians of Comedy, like that I would count because that's almost half documentary.
Well, then a lot of the movies that I watch don't count in your opinion, but they count in mine.
In my rule book, right?
Yeah.
So what would you say is I'm kind of fascinated by this because it's such a project. What would you say is the ratio to movies you have already seen and have not seen?
Most of the movies are movies that I have not seen. I'm really trying to watch like new movies, new things I haven't seen before. But every once in a while, it's just, you know, it's a day where I can't watch a new movie again. I don't want to get disappointed because there's some bad movies out there. Trust me, I've seen them. But yeah, so then I'll just watch something that I know is going to be good. But for the most part, it's new. It's brand new movies I've never seen before. And not brand new, just movies that I've never seen before specifically. So it could be a movie from like the 1930s, but as long as I haven't seen it, then I'm up for it.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is counts the movies you're seeing in theaters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, It Comes at Night, you will have counted as one of your days, right?
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What have you, I mean, you're, what, 4 months into this? What have you learned
six,
so far?
Girl. I'm 6 months into this.
what's time, really? Time, dates, it's all a construct.
Sure.
But if we're talking about this, like, what would you say if you learned, generally speaking, like, either about yourself or movies or the streaming services or what your endurance for this, that, or the other?
I mean, it's definitely an endurance trial, because I started this really just because I was watching, like, a lot of TV and not a lot of movies, and I was like, there's a lot of movies out there that I haven't seen or want to watch again that I just, like, haven't made time for, so, you know, that was the start of it. But, I mean, I'm 170 movies in, and it is hard. There have been so many days, and I wanted to quit. But, you know, I've gone so long and I forced myself to keep going. It's a lot harder than it sounds. It doesn't sound like it's that difficult to just watch a movie then every day. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in everyday life. I am an adult human and I have adult human things I have to get done. So,
right.
I kind of have to work around my schedule and make sure things work. Like if I want to go out with my friends, then I'll have to watch a movie. I'll have to watch two movies the next day, things like that. Mm-hmm. So on that note, I've learned that it's a lot harder than I thought it would be.
I mean, I wouldn't consider this an easy project at all. It sounds super daunting. I know how daunting it is for me just to be able to, like, catch the Netflix homework or be able to see a movie to review at the end of the week. Like, and I, you know, I'm not, like, trying to do it every day, although I always say, like, I'm going to try and go out and see more.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really difficult as it is, and I'm a person who actually enjoys doing that. But I will say, you doing this project has made it easier for me to convince you to go out and see movies. Because now it's like kind of a thing. So you're like, so if I'm like, hey, this weird thing's gonna play, you're usually up for it.
Mm-hmm. Except for that one night.
Right. Speaking of, the new Beverly looks like is going to be doing David Cronenberg movies for their midnight shows all next month.
Woo!
If you've never seen Videodrome, that's what they're playing Saturday the 1st.
That was just the first Cronenberg movie that I saw.
It was?
Yeah.
That is a weird one.
I know.
to lose your David Cronenberg virginity on. Because that is, like, unfiltered Cronenberg all the way.
That is the most Cronenberg you're going to get.
Yes.
I know. I was fascinated by it, though. And I love Debbie Harry, and she's in it. And I was just like, I'm in. I'm fully in. Weird things to do with flesh, and Debbie Harry is in it. I am fully in. And then I watched it, and I was like, what is this? I think I was, like, 13.
Right. Yeah. I think that movie, like, exploded my brain when I was, like, 23. But anyway, let's go ahead and get into the movie news.
Movie news. Talk about that movie news.
Thank you for joining me here tonight.
Of course.
And we'll start with this one because you sounded like you had opinions about it. Cowboy Bebop, famous anime that you probably watched on Toonami back in the late 90s, early
2000s. Oh, Toonami. No, it was not Toonami. It was Adult Swim. It was the Saturday night anime of Adult Swim. Mm-hmm. And
there was a weird, like, blurry, like, era when they used to show Toonami twice a day, and they showed, like, kind of the more grown-up ones at night and the more, like, kiddie stuff during the day. But before Adult Swim was fully an empire. So anyway, Cowboy Bebop is set for a live-action remake because, of course, from the writer of Thor: The Dark World.
Yeah.
so far my least favorite Thor of the two there have been.
I mean, to be fair to this guy, he's apparently also writing Thor Ragnarok, which from the trailer looks incredible.
Very good trailer.
I don't know if that means anything, because trailers don't mean really jack compared to the actual film, but I mean, it looks great and I'm excited about it. And if he had something to do with it, I'll give him credit for that. But yeah, Thor to the Dark World is not my fave. Not my fave at all.
Not really whatsoever. However, I will say this. I'm less excited about whatever his name is, Christopher Yost, who wrote Thor, the Dark World. But the new one is being directed by Taika Waititi, who did Eagle vs. Shark and What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, you mean Thor Ragnarok is being directed by...
Yeah, for Ragnarok.
Right. Okay.
So hopefully he'll bring something to it. But anyway, we're not talking about what we should be talking about.
I thought you were talking about Cowboy Bebop, and I was about to be like, oh, okay, I think I can actually enjoy this now. And you're not talking about that, and therefore I'm back to being angry.
Now, I never really watched Cowboy Bebop. I think I saw the Cowboy Bebop movie.
Okay, so I watched the Cowboy Bebop. There's two movies that I know of anyway. Don't quote me on that. And they're both great. And I watched the whole series, and I read all of the manga on it. So I love Cowboy Bebop, like, more than anybody should. And the ending episode of the series, it was only 26 episodes for anybody that doesn't know. The ending episode, I cried my freaking eyes out. I was 13 and I was a goth kid and I was just so upset. And I, anyway, it's very important to me. This is clearly very important to me.
But you have very little to no hype about this project.
Absolutely not. Every time they bring an anime movie to a full feature film, they do it wrong. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we all... Well, actually, I did not go and see... what was that one with Scarlett Johansson?
Oh, Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, Ghost in the Shell. I watched the original Ghost in the Shell movie. It was good. And I did not watch the remake, but I read all of the very angry articles about the whitewashing and also the you know, trying to not do the whitewashing in the movie. They, like, explained it away in the film or whatever.
Yeah, in kind of a weird, clumsy way.
Yeah. I mean, clearly that was not going anywhere fast. And I don't expect it to go very far with Cowboy Bebop. And that sucks, because it deserves something good, but I don't think that they can do it. Because when it comes to American studios and something from Japanese animated series, they just don't know how to commingle those two things and make them into something good. And it's usually because they, once again, are going to hire white actors, you know?
Yeah, yeah, it's one of those weird things. It's like video game movies. They just haven't cracked the code on it yet.
Yeah.
Like, there hasn't been a great video game movie yet. There hasn't been a great anime adaptation yet, for some reason. And you think, like, I mean... You have, like, The Matrix or whatever, which is essentially a kind of... it's super informed by the style of anime.
Right.
But yeah, just, you know, what, Aeon Flux was kind of whatever. The Dragon Ball Evolution was really terrible. There's a cult following for Speed Racer, but I am not of that cult following.
I love Speed Racer, but it is so ridiculous. Like, I love how ridiculous it is, because the original series was ridiculous. So, I'm fully hyped about that movie, actually. I want to rewatch that. That's going to be one of my movies.
Maybe I should look at it again. All right. Next story.
Okay.
Coraline and Nightmare Before Christmas director Henry Selick is coming to television. Little Nightmares, which is based on a video game. As we were just talking about.
Which we did not play.
The story involves a 9-year-old girl named Six who must escape from the bottom of a ship by facing against various evil villains. I'm reading this off of IndieWire. The Russo brothers are collaborating. What's your feelings?
I mean, I don't really have many feelings, just because I didn't play the video game. So, you know, I don't really know what to expect out of it. Let me Google to be honest. Can I Google for a second?
Oh, Google away.
Okay.
Feel free to Google.
Ooh, it looks gorgeous. So if you look up the visuals for the actual video game, it looks really fun. It's totally Coraline-esque, and I could see it turning into really fun animated feature. The fact that they're making it into a television series is a little interesting. Do you know what...
Who plans to release it?
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't say. Let me see. Little Nightmares, Selleck. Then it talks about Selleck. Then it talks about the Russo brothers. Yeah, I don't.
Maybe they're just making the pilot.
Yeah, probably. I'm guessing they're probably gonna like get a pilot together and then see who wants it. Little Nightmares will most likely debut before any of Selleck's current film projects.
Mm-hmm.
He's also working on something called The Shadow King for Disney.
What I do feel strongly about is that the Russo brothers are involved. I love the Russo brothers.
They're TV people.
Yeah. They worked on Community, which you know I love. And they're fantastic. And of course they worked on some of the Avengers movies. I don't remember which ones right now.
Oh, they did the last two Captain America movies.
Oh, right. Perfect. So, yeah.
Civil War and Winter Soldier.
And Winter Soldier is probably one of the best Marvel movies that have come out. So,
for sure.
Sorry?
I said for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So, I think I'm on board just because of them. The fact that Henry Selick is involved is really exciting as well. I, again, don't know anything about Little Nightmares, but from the visuals alone, it looks really cool, and I'm interested. I'm down.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the video game. I don't know if it should be adapted or what kind of expectations people have for it, but I like the people involved, and especially Henry Selick. I'm a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to see kind of what he brings to this. I love Coraline. I think still that's my favorite Laika film.
Ooh. Sorry, I just read the last line of this article, and it says that the Russo brothers are working under a project, including an original sci-fi movie from Swiss Army Man directors, the Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
I am very interested in that. Have you seen Swiss Army Man?
No, I rented it, towards the end of the year to rank it somewhere on my year end.
Yeah.
Because I know that a lot of people liked it.
Yeah.
But I never got around to watching it.
Oh, I have the DVD. I'll give it to you.
Is it good? I guess you liked it.
It's crazy. It looked fantastic. So for the listeners at home, if you haven't seen Swiss Army Man, if you have seen the music video for Turn Down for What, or the Adult Swim short film, Too Many Cooks. All of these things are from the same directors, Daniel Scheinart and Daniel Kwan. And they're all very similar in insanity nature. Like they're very weird. And, they have some interesting ideas about, how the male penis works. in all three of those, weirdly enough. So yeah, I'm really interested in everything they do. Anyway, sorry, that's just like a minor line.
No, that's interesting. A story within a story.
Yeah.
Okay, and the last one I sent you. What does it say?
Jessica Chastain is in talks to play the villain in the next X-Men movie. It's called X-Men Dark Phoenix, and she will be playing Lilandra, the Shi'ar Empress. Shi'ar, is that how you say it?
Yep.
Okay.
You got it.
I have no idea who that is.
Did you see the last X-Men movie, the Apocalypse one?
I did. It was one of my movies.
Yeah. It was kind of whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I liked it because all I heard was nothing but bad things. So I actually kind of thought it was okay. So maybe because my expectations were so low that I liked it better than other people did. But yeah, it definitely was not nearly as good as Days of Future Past. But there were parts about it that I liked. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt about it. It was not great. But I thought that it was better than its reputation.
Yeah.
By the time I saw it, which was like a week after the reviews were pouring in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm not pumped about them trying to tackle Dark Phoenix again, especially if they're not going to do the legwork. It's like what they're doing with fucking Venom. It's like, to do Venom, you have to introduce the black suit. You have to have a period where Spider-Man's, like, happy with the black suit. Then you have to have a period where he's not happy with the black suit. Then you have to explain how it gets to Eddie Brock. Then you can do Venom. That's, like, three movies minimum. With the Phoenix, they just keep rushing straight to the Dark Phoenix saga, because that's where all the drama is. But there's a whole, like, arc there. They go up into outer space, they encounter the fucking Phoenix out as this, like, cosmic whatever, while they're battling some bullshit with the Shi'ar, and then they come back to Earth, and she's this super-powered light Phoenix, or the good Phoenix, and she's just, like, realizing all of her psychic powers. Jean Grey is realizing all of her psychic powers in a way she never has been able to before. And then eventually it turns dark and she turns on all of her friends, and it's a long arc and it should be done, you know. And I'm not like saying this is like a like nerdy fanboy, like, oh, like the comic books have to be exactly the same, but there's so much to explain in just the idea of the Phoenix. That to just go straight to Dark Phoenix, like, I know, like, with the original Singer, or the Brett Ratner one, the third one, they basically wrote it out as just something altogether. It's not even a cosmic force. But if they're introducing Lilandra, then they're for sure going to be bringing it up that way. So, I don't know. I just, to me, I'm getting red flags. Biting off more than you can chew. Do something else. Do the Brood or something.
I mean, I'm not sure how I feel about, I don't know. I like the Dark Phoenix saga, so it's interesting to me, because it's one of the very, because I'm not as much as a X-Men comic book fan as you are. I'm much more of like a, you know, I know much more about like the Batman side of things than I do about X-Men.
Sure.
But, I always thought that was a really interesting storyline. So I like them to do it the right way, but I do see what you're saying, because they did do it wrong, especially with Spider-Man. I mean, Spider-Man 3, let's be real. It's awful. Yeah. and also X-Men 3, awful. Not a great movie. And yeah, it does, in that movie especially, it feels smooshed. Like, they just kind of were like, well, Jean Grey died, so let's just also talk about this other thing that happened that no one has ever spoken of before in the other two movies, you know?
Right.
So, you're right. I feel like they should have been, like, bringing this up for a while now, and Jean Grey was only in, like, a small portion of the last movie, so it's not really gonna work if they're gonna make it into a, like, a full-on saga, which is what it is. I mean, Dark Phoenix saga is a saga, like, it's a very long running story. And I mean, the fact that they're bringing it to space is kind of cool, because we haven't seen that in the X-Men series so far, right?
Yeah, that is one of the biggest things about X-Men and the original Singerverse. His kind of vision of the X-Men was more, he was much more interested in X-Men as an allegory for social justice. And, you know, given, like, you know, his like, Jewish background, and given his gay background, it makes sense that that was the angle he would come at. And he brought it down to Earth, both literally and figuratively. Like, it's not as expansive of a universe in those first two or three movies, especially, as the Marvel X-Men has always been, which goes all over the place. And you're talking about, like, you know, like the Marvel movies, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, it's gone there. It's in Weirdoville now with Guardians of the Galaxy and that kind of stuff. They could do Shi'ar, no problem. The X-Men movies, as they are up to this point, they're dipping their toe a little bit into the sci-fi weirdness that is X-Men, with, like, time travel and robots and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But, I don't know if they're up to cosmic weird yet, but we'll see how they pull it off.
I mean, they pulled off that kind of thing in Guardians of the Galaxy. That's a totally different area because Marvel can do a lot of things that Fox has gotten very wrong. I think we both remember the horribleness that was the Fantastic Four movie.
Right.
They can definitely do a wrong. So, you know, they can do it right. We've seen it in Guardians of the Galaxy where it's this, like, story that comes out of frickin' nowhere, but it works. Somehow they make it work. But you have to have the right director, you have to write the right cast, you have to write the right, you know, everything going on around it in order to make it work. And what's going on with it right now, I'm not sure if they're there, you know. Although Jessica Chastain is fantastic, and she would she would be a great villain.
She would, and I, even though Lalandra's not really a villain in the comics anyway, but I do think that she is... Jessica Chastain's great at just about everything. She is, like, the American Kate Blanchett.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. You know, I'm down with this to see her in an X-Men film. I think that's a good... That's some good casting. Yeah, I just want to know what their angle is here.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's kind of a wait and see. You know? Sure. It's like I'm cautious. I'm very cautious about it. I'm not even cautiously optimistic. I'm just cautious. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about what do we want to do? Do we want to like do we want to do Captain Underpants first, or we want to do It Comes at Night first?
Let's go happy first.
Okay. Yeah. Why don't you describe to me the plot of Captain Underpants' first epic movie?
So Captain Underpants, as a storyline, from both the book series and, from the movie, is about these two boys, George and Harold, who are best friends, who like to play pranks on their teachers and principal in their school because their principal and their teachers are horrible and they just want to take away all of their fun out of learning at school and stuff like that. So at one point they start making a comic book series called Captain Underpants, which stars their principal as a obviously underpants clad hero. who saves the day and stuff like that.
Right.
And eventually it gets to a point where, they have to somehow get their principal who wants to split them up. He wants to take them away from each other's classes and split them into different classes. In order to get him to stop doing that, they have to somehow get him to be Captain Underpants. And I don't know if I should give away how they do that.
Oh, I thought that was part of, like, the lore like, that everyone knows.
Right? It is a part of the lore, but I don't know. Maybe people haven't read the books. You didn't read the books.
I didn't. I knew what Captain Underpants was vaguely. Like, I remember it, like, you know, being in, like, the catalogs or whatever when you go, like, order books from grade school.
Right.
I remember seeing them, like, in the children's sections and stuff, and it might have been a little after my time, to be honest. But when I watched the movie, I just decided to go with it. Like, you know, I was very open-minded into the movie, just like, I don't know anything about this. I liked a lot of the voice talent. Nick Stoller co-wrote the movie with Dave Pilkey or whatever. Is that the
Dave
guy?
Pilkey.
That Yeah.
Yeah.
Who wrote the novel. So. Mm-hmm. Nick Stoller had directed The Muppets, or had not directed, well, he did, yes, he wrote and directed The Muppet movies, the first one, in, or the first reboot, the one with
Jason Segel,
yeah. Yes, and Get Him to the Greek, and,
I didn't know he did that.
Yeah, all the Jason Segel-y ones.
Oh, that's interesting.
Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Mm-hmm. So he comes from that Apatow world, and he co-wrote this. David Soren directing the animation here. And then Thomas Middleditch and Kevin Hart doing the lead voices, and Ed Helms doing the voice of Captain Underpants / Principal Krupp.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Kroll doing the voice of the villain, Professor Poopy Pants. So, yeah, I kind of went into this blindfolded, had no idea what it was. And I, you know, given that I didn't have any kind of affinity for the source material, I was able to sort of fall into the imagination of the movie pretty easily.
Uh-huh.
I like the animation style. I think I commented when I was with you guys when we went and saw it that it reminded me of the newer Peanuts movie.
Oh, yeah.
Where
yeah,
it
yeah.
has this super stylized, super cartoonish look to it. But they add sort of a, like, almost a felt-like texture to uh-huh. the the people's skin and that kind of stuff. So it has this, has a little bit more heft to it
mm-hmm.
than just like a normal, like, I don't know, like Madagascar looking thing.
It also makes it feel like a little bit more real because it has texture to it. Because it feels like they have actual like hair on their skin, which everybody does, right? But then it also right. is very cartoonish. So they're not trying to go towards the more like 3D realistic type right. of 3D animation, which doesn't work because when you're working with something like this kind of movie, I mean, obviously you don't want to go realistic. You want to go in the complete opposite direction and you want to go more cartoony. But the fact that they included that texture to it made it feel somehow real and yet still a cartoon, which is a really good combination. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, definitely. So, mm-hmm. I definitely appreciate the look. I think Kevin Hart and Thomas Middleditch do really good voice acting. Their characters have chemistry. It's not two actors I would immediately think of us putting in a movie together, but they do have pretty good comedic chemistry.
Yeah, that was surprising. Someone from, you know, comedy, a stand-up background, and somebody from Silicon Valley as playing a giant nerd. Definitely didn't think those right. two would come together, but they did, and they worked really well together.
Mm-hmm. Well, Middleditch in particular has largely a theater/improv background. Mm-hmm. So he's done bigger, weirder characters than his character on Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, usually he does kind of outlandish characters. So his character on Silicon Valley is sort of abnormal for him, but that's what most people know him from now.
Where have you seen him play an outlandish character?
He does a pretty famous character from all these online videos. I forgot. I think they were College Humor even, like a long time ago. He played this character called Doob or Doobs. And he's like this office weirdo. Like, I don't know. You would have to watch them. They don't date incredibly well. This was like when there wasn't a lot of people making online comedy.
Right. Yeah.
So the competition wasn't as high yet, but it's a somewhat famous character and he still gets quoted as from that. But, you know, if you've seen him, like, him in interviews and stuff like that, even on, like, Conan and those kind of things, he's usually doing much broader comedy.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, so he's good in that. I'll say, as far as my feelings on the movie as a whole, I enjoyed it, but I did think it skewed pretty young.
I mean, yeah.
And I definitely felt that I was not the target audience for the movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it's for children. It's pretty mm-hmm. clear. It's Captain Underpants, you know. You're not going to go for somebody in their mid-30s. You're going to go for somebody who's, you know, maybe 10.
Excuse me, I am in my early 30s.
That's not what I meant, and you know it.
So yeah, there's a lot of scatological and like, you know, fart jokes and that kind of stuff, which didn't do a ton for me.
Yeah,
there's some like good visual gags. There's a whole bit in the middle with the sock puppets. That was probably my favorite part of the whole movie.
Right. What I do like about it is that it actually does play to the actual books. It's actually mm-hmm. a combination of the first three books. So the storyline kind of combines all three of those, which is why Mr. Poopy Pants is the villain. He's actually not the villain in the first book. He's in, either the second or the third. I can't remember, to be honest. And then they do include, well, you know what? That's going too far into the lore of it. never mind that. But yeah, so, they keep with it. There's a part in every single Captain Underpants book where they have a flipbook, mm-hmm. and they make a flipbook style, action sequence where you have to place your finger right here and then flip the book over here. And they actually have actual finger placements on the mm-hmm. book for you to do it. And they do that in the movie, which is cool. It definitely plays to the original books really, really well. I can understand what you're saying with, like, obviously it kind of plays to juvenile humor, but it also has some pretty interesting moments. Like there's a moment in it where they're playing an orchestra of farts.
Right.
Which is so juvenile, and it almost lost me. And then at the very end of that, they played a whole bunch of, like Oscar worthy, like quotes from reviewers and stuff like that about how epic it was.
Right.
Which actually made me laugh. So it played to both the childish, like, you know, lesser humor, and also like, this is actually really funny. The, the Oscar movie quotes. So, you know, right. it played off on both ends. Like, it was for adults, but it was also for children, which is good. It's always a good combination to, allow for humor for adults, because those are the people that are actually paying for the movie in the first place. So,
there's a decent combination of highbrow and lowbrow.
Yeah.
I think the general heart of the movie pulls you through the story stuff,
because
mm-hmm. you really care about Harold and
George,
his friend. You care about them so much, George and Harold.
You care about
their friendship, and you care about, like, you know, I was vaguely invested in, like, the Crump / Underpants, like, how that's going to resolve
mm-hmm.
and that kind of stuff. I actually feel like the Poopy Pants stuff was not... Maybe story-wise, it's not entirely necessary.
Yeah.
I think you have enough conflict with, oh, man, our principal is a lunatic right now. Like, I don't know what we're going to do. We have to kind of hide him around. And like, there's kind of like some, you know, I don't know how you would really qualify. Almost sort of like a Weekend of Bernie's-ish type situation with him.
What?
I mean, he's not dead, but they kind of have to sort of steer him around and sort of puppet him in a certain kind of way.
Underpants. I was like, Poopy Pants is not dead.
No. I mean, with Underpants, I think there's enough kind of shenanigans there that you don't need to introduce a villain in the last third.
Right.
I mean, they build it up naturally enough. But yeah, I think the last third of the movie feels a little cluttered.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you think about that?
I'll say that as well. The Poopy Pants kind of thing just kind of comes out of nowhere and doesn't really add too much. I know why they did it, because they wanted to play to the original books, and in every single book there's a new villain. So they wanted to include one of those, and I get that, but you didn't really need that.
Or at the very least, they could have integrated it a little more organically.
Yeah. I mean, I totally see what you're saying. Although I do like Nick Kroll as Professor Poopy Pants, because he actually does a really good job playing up to his character. And, mm-hmm. you know, the whole thing about him hating his name his whole life, so that's why he wants to get rid of laughter. It's interesting and it's fun. And, I absolutely do agree. That's probably the worst part of the movie for me, is just it didn't really play along with the rest of the storyline about, like, what are they going to do with their principal now that they've done mm-hmm. this to him and stuff like that. But it's just sort of a side story. But I see why they did it, and, you know, I think they did their best with it.
Yeah, it's not, like, a huge problem, for sure. And, like, uh-huh. the movie's so light on its toes. It kind of goes all these crazy directions anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a huge problem by any means.
Yeah.
I think I wrote in my review, like, something to the effect of, like, you know, I feel like the reason this movie has so much comedic weight behind it in the pedigree is because all of these comedians, especially the angle they're sort of playing, is, like, the celebration of the class clown.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you could definitely see, like, if there is a tourist vision here, that it's all of them kind of playing up to that, like, that memory of being, like, the weird outsider in school who, like, had, you know, was able to find that one other outsider, maybe another, who their thing was making fun of how ridiculous the entire school institution is.
Mm-hmm.
And those, that's basically your mini comedians, and you know, before they grow up anyway.
Well, I think so, I think also a theme is just like just trying to find your creativity, even though other people are trying to take that away from you and stuff like that. Because, you know,
sure.
I mean, the whole story is about how the principal is trying to take away their comic books. So, you know.
Yeah. No, I mildly recommend it. I can't say I was over the moon about it. I might have enjoyed it more when I was like 10.
Yeah. So I would say, like, you can take your kids to it. For anyone else, you know, if you watch the, if you read the books when you were a kid, it's definitely a nostalgia boner. So I really liked it because I was super into the books when I was a kid. But I probably would not have paid to see the movie. I would have watched it at home on Netflix or HBO Go.
Right,
so,
right. Or on an airplane or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Let's get depressed. Let's talk about...
Okay.
Let's talk about It Comes at Night.
It Comes at Night.
And I'll describe this one.
Okay.
This is an independent film that's released by A24. I think every time I review an A24 film on my podcast, I always sort of talk about like how they're sort of positioning themselves in this interesting way of like they're of doing these sort of genre films, like the last year's The Witch or this film, or I believe was It Follows A24. I want to say maybe.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think so was Green Room.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing these kind of low-budget, independent genre films, and sort of the word art house horror has been used to describe a lot of these films.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a term that I slightly take umbrage with.
They're also doing the movie Room, the one that won the Oscar for Best Actress. Yeah. So, you know, that's not their only...
not their
genre,
only thing.
But I see what you're saying. Yeah.
But I think the A24 horror film or the A24 genre film is sort of a brand in unto itself at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of follows along with that. Trey Edward Schultz is the writer director here. This was released through Joel Edgerton's or made through one of his production company, the Animal Kingdom.
Oh.
And Joel Edgerton stars in the film as this father of a family that survived a major plague that's killed most of the Earth's population. We're living in the post-apocalypse. It's man against man. You know, I think I told somebody when I was sort of describing the movie to them, it's like this feels like it could take place in the same world as Cormac McCarthy's The Road.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not quite as bleak, but pretty close. And Joel Edgerton is trying to take care of his family. He has a teenage son, a 17-year-old son, and his wife. And they just recently had to exile his wife's father and basically put him to pasture and bury him. Because he had caught the plague, the disease that's killing everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the very first scene of the movie. And, you know, both metaphorically and literally, there's sort of the specter of this tragedy that hangs over the rest of what's going on here. Eventually, Christopher Abbott from Girls, people might recognize him from that.
Something Charlie and Girls.
Yeah, the poor sap. I mean, he was kind of lovably pathetic in that show, but anyway, he's trying to break into their place because he has his own family, a toddler and a young wife, who they're trying to make it. And Joel Edgerton's wife, Sarah, played by Carmen Ejogo,
sure.
She tries to convince them, like, hey, we need to, like, you know, try and be human beings, and let's try and create a society, not just hoard all of our shit to ourselves. We need to actually try and like create a community. So they invite them in, and the rest of the movie sort of explores the tensions and the paranoia of, you know, are they on the level? Are they not? You know, are they Do they have the disease? Do they not? You know, and it's all about kind of playing around with tension.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get into the actual what we thought of the movie, were you aware of this, like, controversy around it?
No.
So, I never watched the trailer. Even now, I probably should have, but I have never seen the trailer. I heard about the movie, and I saw, like, the cast and stuff and thought it sounded interesting, so I went and saw it, but I guess the trailer is selling this as much more of a straightforward boo scare horror film. And so right now, if you look on Rotten Tomato, it has one of the highest disparities between the critics' ratings and the user review ratings.
Oh, yeah,
ratings.
I did see that, and I thought that was weird.
Yeah. And this is also something that kind of comes up a lot with these A24 horror films, is critics seem to like them a whole lot more than the average viewer. And I guess, you know, from there we can talk. What did you think about It Comes at Night?
It definitely has the same type of tone as The Witch. And except obviously it takes place in a much more futuristic time. But it definitely shares the same tone. It's definitely very bleak. And I gotta say, I really hated Joel Edgerton throughout the movie.
Fair enough.
Which I think you're kind of supposed to, you know, it's kind of like you're supposed to understand where he's coming from, but at the same time, you really don't like him and you wish that you didn't have to be in the same room as him. I loved Christopher Abbott, Charlie from Girls. I thought he played it very, very well. Riley Keough, who plays his wife, was very sweet, and she always kind of plays the same type of character where, you know, she was in Mad Max.
Right.
Yeah, she was the redheaded Mad Max, and so she was just kind of like the woman who, you know, was there to talk and stuff. And I feel like that was kind of her role in this movie too, is that she was, you know, a beautiful woman who is there to talk if you need her, you know? So she kind of plays a background role in that, which was kind of disappointing, to be honest. But I really liked Christopher Abbott in it. I thought he did a fantastic job. Who is the one that plays the kid, the 17-year-old?
Kelvin Harrison Jr.?
Okay.
Travis is the character's name?
Yeah. The thing that was going on with him the whole movie was it's really strange and kind of jarring, and I can see why people didn't like that part of it, because he... Nothing really bad happens. It's just he has a lot of really bad dreams.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned at the top of the review that, like, you know, the first scene we see in the movie is them having to essentially kill and bury their grandfather.
Right.
And I think that's psychologically plays out throughout the whole movie.
Especially on him, yes.
Especially on him, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, actually, you know, Joel Edgerton is probably top billing here, but I think Kelvin Harrison Jr. is probably more the main
star.
Character,
yeah,
because it's the movie's much more from his perspective than everyone else.
Absolutely, yes. What are your thoughts?
I liked it a lot. I didn't love it as much as, like, I loved The Witch.
Yeah,
because
that's exactly how I felt. Yeah,
there's very few things in the world I love more than The Witch. maybe if they had had a talking goat in this movie, I might have upped the points a little bit. But I thought it was very psychologically taught. I thought that stuff all plays really well. I thought that it reminded me a lot of John Carpenter's The Thing. Mm-hmm. And that kind of everyone is suspicious of each other. Nobody knows, you know, like, what the boundaries are. There's absolutely, even though everyone's trying to pretend like they're in it for each other and they're trying to help each other, ultimately it's every man for himself. So that I dug. Also, I think the themes of masculinity are really interesting here, especially with Joel Edgerton.
Yeah.
He's playing the man, you know, the father, and he sees himself as sort of the caregiver of this whole situation.
Yeah.
To the detriment of the situation. I think the way that plays out, then Kelvin Harrison is becoming a man. They kill the oldest oldest patriarch in the family. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the themes of masculinity are running out through this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the key sequence for me in this movie is that conversation between Kelvin Harrison Jr. as the son and Riley Koff as
Keough
as Christopher Abbott's wife.
Yeah.
There's this little flirtation kind of going there. And if this was like, I don't know, a whole season of Walking Dead, they could play out that relationship. But yeah, I thought it was subtle. Maybe so subtle that a lot of people are going to kind of shrug by the end and go, okay,
yeah,
it's an end of the world thing, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I thought that it played its cards pretty well. There is something about it that feels very short story to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like I could see myself reading this exact story in like a novella or like a 30 page short story.
Yeah, and speaking of the thing, there's the one scene in the thing where he's like burning the blood to try and find who is actually the thing. That scene is basically this whole movie. Is just like them trying to figure out, okay, who is it? But it's all psychological. No one actually says out loud, all right, who is this? Like that kind of thing. It's all psychological. It's all internal. And it's just them like feeling the tension amongst each other, but not saying anything until it all comes to blows. So it's very subtle throughout the whole movie. It's a very subtle tension until it's not subtle at all anymore. I think that is probably why a lot of people are not going to like it, because they're going to go in and expect, oh, it's going to be like one of those big zombie movies. I'm expecting like a full on, like a walker attack. And that's not going to happen. This is an internal story. This is something that happens amongst a few people in a cabin in the woods. And yeah, so it's all psychological horror. It's not actual horror. And I think people were expecting actual horror from the trailer. I actually have seen the trailer. And what it really focused, you don't know anything from the trailer. Like, I didn't know anything about this movie going in, even though I saw the trailer.
Right.
But what it does play it out as is they show the red door lot in the trailer and just kind of keep zooming in on that red door until it opens, and then it shows it comes at night. So it does make it seem like, okay, well, you're waiting to see what's on the other side. And in the movie, you find like, it's not what's on the outside. It's what's on the inside, you know?
Right. Exactly.
Which is probably my biggest problem with the title of this movie is that it doesn't come at night.
I mean, yes, it to me, that is marketing wise the movie's biggest problem.
Yeah,
it should have been called something else. It should have been there is a slight, you know, with all of these films, there's, you know, they have to sell it as something.
Uh-huh.
And they're not going to sell it as, you know, I don't know, some like 14 word poetic sounding thing that nobody's gonna go see. They want to sell it as a genre film.
Yeah, no one saw The Road.
Yeah, that's true. Even though it was popular, a very popular novel and everything, and I think it's a kind of underrated movie. Uh-huh. But yeah, I enjoyed this for what it was.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel.
It's not my favorite of the A24 art house horrors, if you will. Or even though I wouldn't even really call this a horror film, I'd call this more just sort of a psychological thriller.
Mm-hmm.
It has horror undertones. Certainly there's some imagery. You talk about the red door, which certainly brings to mind like Kubrick.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff from The Shining. It reminds me. Yeah, it also brings to mind some of like the hallway stuff, the dark hallway stuff in David Lynch's Lost Highway. So there's some visual nods to that. Actually, I think the cinematography is really cool. Like, has this really kind of inky, dark, bleak minimal lighting kind of stuff. But yeah, I definitely think it is much more of the vegetables portion of your meal rather than the meat and potatoes, if you will.
All right.
You know, it's going to be a little bit of work for people who are expecting a zombie movie.
Yeah, absolutely. For people who are expecting a zombie movie, this is not your movie. But if you liked The Witch, you will like this. The Witch is better, mm-hmm. in my humble opinion, and also in your humble opinion. And, yeah, so it's not bad. It's a good movie for what it is. It's just not what it was, it was expected to be. You know, that's why people, I think, feel disappointed, if anything, is because it wasn't right. what they expected it to be. And I think people would have gone to see it if they had played it in the trailer as what it actually was, you know?
Yeah, but I don't know how you sell this movie either. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I know how you can sell it as a horror film because there's enough kind of gruesome shots or whatever you can string along together a trailer like
yeah.
that. But I don't know how you sell it as family is struggling for their own identity in the woods. Like, and I think that there is a, this, you know, horror, you know, horror as it exists in the world of marketing and horror as it exists as an actual genre
uh-huh.
are kind of two different things.
Uh-huh.
And I think that horror as a genre can be a lot of different things. We can, there, you know, yes, there's schlock. There's like zombie movies and there's like slashers and that kind of stuff. And it's all about, you know, buckets of blood and body counts. But then there's also like something like, I have this theory that if you took, you know, half of what we consider sort of horror classics today, like Rosemary's Baby, Repulsion, The Shining, The Exorcist. If you took a lot of these films and released them today, people would be calling those art house horrors.
Mm.
Even though they're just horror standards by our definitions now.
Mm-hmm. I don't know so, about yeah. The Exorcist. The Exorcist is pretty mainstream, in my opinion.
Right, but if you look, I mean... If you look at, like, The Exorcist compared to, a Blumhouse film, it's a lot longer. They take a lot of time before you see any of the, quote-unquote, Exorcist stuff. There's a lot of character building in that movie. Mm-hmm. Stuff that, like, a horror programmer wouldn't spend its time on these days.
Okay, I can see that.
But anyway, I mildly recommend the movie. I think that it's... I mean, I actually liked it quite a bit, but I think, like, know what it is going in. This yeah. is much more of a character piece and a family drama.
I mean, I kind of knew just on the fact that it was A24. Like, it was definitely right. going to be an art house type of movie rather than just, like, a straight up horror movie. So I kind of knew that going in. So I think I got more out of it because of that, you know? Because actually, if it was just a straight-up horror movie, I probably would have been disappointed.
Yeah, that's the thing. If it was the movie that people thought it was going to be, it would be one in a million.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let's go ahead and get to our final segment now, which is our Netflix / streaming recommendations, because what I'm going to recommend is actually not from Netflix, but I'll have you go first. What should people watch? What are you watching?
First of all, let's explain why we're not doing Netflix homework. So I actually did have Netflix homework. I wanted Cassidy to watch Bad Education, which is a... It's a movie by Pedro Almodovar. A lot of Pedro Almodovar movies are playing on Hulu right now, including mm-hmm. All About My Mother, Bad Education, Law of Desire, which is my next movie. I haven't seen that one yet. And Broken Embraces. And I love Almodovar. He's a fantastic filmmaker. He has an incredible visual style, but he also takes elements of like Spanish soap opera type of storylines and then kind of turns them on their heads. and turns him into something completely different. So it's really interesting just to see what he does to play with like natural tropes and changes them up, to make them new and interesting. But also his visual style is very beautiful. So I highly recommend pretty much anything from, Pedro Almodovar, and a lot of his movies are playing on, not Netflix. They're playing on Hulu right now.
Right. What would you say is your favorite Almodovar film, generally speaking? Not even just the ones that they can watch.
Oh, gosh. I mean, Bad Education was the first movie that I saw from his, and I really loved it. But let's see. No, actually, to be honest, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown is probably my favorite so far. It's really funny. It's really fun just to watch. It's a comedy, but it's also like a very dark comedy. Again, it plays on the Spanish soap opera tropes, but it is, it's definitely not what you'd expect going into it. I highly recommend that movie. It's really fun. And it's one of his older movies, so you're not going to get the same visual style as you would from like his newer films, like what's the one with the skin?
What is that? Might be my favorite. What is it called?
What's it called?
Hold on. The Skin I Live In.
The Skin I Live In. Yes, thank you. It's not going to have the same visual style as The Skin I Live In just because it's an older movie, but it's very, very fun and it's very good. I haven't seen Tie Me Up and Tie Me Down yet, and I really want to see that. So I'm still learning on my full oeuvre of Almodovar.
Well, he's done a lot of films. He's been going strong since the mid '80s. I think generally speaking, when you ask people their favorite, it's either Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. It's either that or Talk to Her. Yeah. The ones you hear about the most.
My sister loves Talk to Her. That's her favorite, Almodovar. She had a cat named Almodovar.
he does have this very peculiar style because he's very, very stylish. It's kind of apocryphal to say, but for those who don't know, I would say he's almost kind of like the Spanish Tarantino in the sense that when you see one of his movies, you know immediately that you're seeing one of his movies.
Yeah.
Because his visual style is so his own, and he is kind of like flipping the script on like common tropes and narratives. And his stuff is like almost melodramatic in a celebratory way.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, also another fun thing that kind of ties into Tarantino. He also plays within his own universe of movies. So the entire plot line of Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown is the plot of the movie within the movie of Broken Embraces. So
right.
Fun there fact all around, but also it kind of ties into what you're saying.
Yeah. In fact, I actually started Bad Education, which I had not seen. That's one I haven't seen. When I started it, I could tell like immediately that the opening was like riffing on the Saul Bass intro to Psycho. He has that same kind of cine literacy as Tarantino, but obviously to a much different means.
Yes.
But yes, I would say like people who think of like foreign films or Spanish films or whatever, European films as like really snooty, artsy, like boring, you know, whatever. Like, see an Almodovar film. It might change your mind on that. I love The Skin I Live In because I think it's just wonderfully perverted and twisted, and it plays on horror tropes that I really like, as well as melodrama. It's a bizarre film, and it's I love that one.
That was the
first one I saw, though. okay, my recommendation, also not from Netflix. This comes from Amazon. I started watching when I was in Vegas. My friends, we were trying to look for something to watch. They're on a completely different sleep schedule than I am. They both work graveyards. So they're like, I'm falling asleep at like 3, and they're like, that's midday for them. We started watching this show on Amazon called Red Oaks. Have you heard or seen anything about this?
No.
So Red Oaks is like it's produced by David Gordon Green and Steven Soderbergh. And David Gordon Green directs a lot of the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I think he directs the pilot to both seasons, maybe some of the last episodes as well. And he, but also, it's like a who's who of indie directors, like 90s indie directors who do directing duties. You have Amy Heckerling of Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Clueless fame. She does a bunch of episodes. Greg Araki does a bunch of episodes. And Hal Hartley does a bunch of episodes.
Wow.
So, yeah, big pedigree there. And then on top of it, the adult cast, because the main characters are mostly like early 20s or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the adult cast, who plays a lot of these kids' parents, includes Richard Kind, Jennifer Grey, Paul Reiser, and John Hodgman is in there for a little bit, and Gina Gershon.
Oh.
And it's the basic plot is it's kind of riffing on that whole like 80s Caddyshack coming of age thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's about this kid who who's kind of comes from like a lower middle class family. Richard Kind and Jennifer Grey play his parents. And they're having, like, marital troubles, and Richard Kind just had, like, a heart attack, so he's, like, trying to get his shit together. So the kid, like, starts working at this summer country club in Jersey where all these, like, millionaires go. It's basically just, yeah, it's basically just, like, a best summer ever sort of movie played out in season-long television format. Hmm. And it takes place in 1984, I think the first season starts in 84, but it's not like beating you over the head with 80s references. Right. It's very subtly 80s. Some of the characters look like super, like big hair and everything, but a lot of them don't. And it's just really well told. I think the trailer, if you watch the trailer for the first or second season, mm-hmm. they're really trying to sell it as like this wacky comedy kind of thing. Like you would think it's more like Wet Hot American Summer based on the trailer, but it's actually like this really kind of more like indie dramedy kind of feel to it. Like, mm-hmm. And I just was like really taken by the show, like considering I knew nothing about it before and never even heard of it. Like I was by the middle of the show, by the middle of me was like watching, I was like, this is so freaking good. Like every episode, there's one kind of kooky, weird episode that I think is like sort of dorky. It's like a body swap episode and it comes out of nowhere and it has nothing to do with the rest of the show. But everything else I thought was like really top notch. And I'm excited for the show to continue, but it also feels like it kind of has to have a short shelf life given like just the nature of what the story is.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I highly recommend everyone watch Red Oaks on Amazon.
Okay. So I have like 8 more recommendations to be honest with you. Cause I mean, you know, I've seen a billion movies at this time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay, I'll ask you this.
Okay.
As just a way of kind of cutting through that. Of all of the movies you've watched, kind of like circling back to our first conversation, all the movies you watch for your like movie a day project,
mm-hmm.
what was the biggest surprise? Like you, like when you watch, you're like, wow, I was glad I watched this. I didn't think I would like it, but I did, or whatever.
This movie, Comet. I watched it on Netflix, and it's a really indie movie. It's just about a couple. And it's Justin Long and Emmy Rossum. And I didn't think that I would get that emotionally involved in a Justin Long movie, to be honest, but it is really good. Like really good. It's this couple that lives in a parallel universe. And you just kind of skip around time throughout their relationship. And it's really, really, really good. I was pleasantly surprised because it was just kind of a movie that was there. It was short enough that I was like, okay, I can sleep after this. And it was really, really, really good. So I highly recommend that movie.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. I'll take a look at it. Maybe I'll make it Netflix homework one of these other times.
All right.
Okay, well, that's the show. And before I get into all my plugs and all the things I have to say at the end of the show, is there anything you want people to follow you on Twitter or on Instagram or anything like that?
I have those things, but I don't do anything with them. So, I mean, you can find me. I think my name is FrankieRue929 on those platforms. If not, good luck.
All right. Well, you can find us at Jabber Podcast on Twitter. You can find our regular podcast archives and our RSS feed at jabberandthedrone.podbean.com. You can email us at jabberandthedrone.gmail.com. You can follow me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy. You can read my reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I've been a little slow on that. I need to get some new stuff up on there that I've reviewed in the last few weeks. What else? I'm used to kind of passing it off to Keith because he has 1,000 things to promote every week.
Wow. Sorry, I'm a little more boring.
No, it's okay. I also don't have my normal sheet that I used to read off of to do this. I'm kind of doing it by my own head. We have friends who also do podcasts. You should be listening to them. Rod and Denise at The Listening Party, Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational, and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics. And Denise's solo podcast, Mascot Diaries, think she's just backloaded a bunch of episodes, and she's starting to get those online now. So do that. And I think Keith will be with us next week, and we'll be reviewing Baby Driver. Something cool is coming out here pretty soon.
Ooh, is Baby Driver coming out next week?
It's like next week or the week after. I know Spider-Man and Baby Driver are coming pretty close.
Oh, I'm in.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for coming on, Amanda Kowalski.
Thank you, Cassidy Robinson.
I'll talk to you later.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.